world of fashion, a beautiful young woman has it all. She's loved and admired by everyone she meets. And prized by those watching from afar. The end result is nothing beautiful at all. Investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere in the first 72 hours. Canada Day. A time for celebration. But not for two young Toronto detectives.
Although this was 25 years ago, in some respects, it seems like just yesterday.
The victim is Cheryl Gardner, a 20-year-old model who recently moved to the city.
She was lying on the floor. She was partially clothed. Her head area had been covered with a blood-soaked sheet and blanket. I was emotionally traumatized by the amount of head injury. A lot of blood, a great deal of horrific head trauma. So much so that we both thought initially this could have been a shotgun wound. We're wondering if this woman had committed suicide, or we checked under the bed just to make sure there wasn't a shotgun or something like that.
No gun is found. This is not a suicide.
What initiated the response by emergency services was a phone call from a person who said that he was the superintendent.
When we talked to the superintendent, he said he made no such call.
If the super didn't make the call to police, who did? While forensic investigators searched the apartment, Detective Boothby orders a canvas of the building's adjacent floors.
I felt very strongly that somewhere, somebody had seen something.
The detectives continue their search for clues.
We noticed that her purse had been opened, her wallet was on the floor.
This is all indicative of robbery or theft.
But the door shows no sign of forced entry. Did Cheryl know her killer and let him in?
We had to do what we call victimology. Who is the victim? What is her lifestyle? Who could have done this? Who are her associates?
We found out that she had a few close friends, a very normal, ambitious young woman who had come to a big city to try to make her mark in life.
But they don't learn much else. Police contact Cheryl Gardner's family in Ottawa.
I was only 15 at the time. I remember being awakened by this incredibly a scream I'd never heard before in my life, and I knew something was really wrong. I knew that something had changed forever because I'd never heard my mom make such a scream. Cheryl was the type of person who I think could have almost done anything. In school, she was very, very good in math and sciences. But she always had this passion for fashion. She was very committed to her career. In fact, the weekend that she was murdered, she was supposed to come home. And she stayed in Toronto because she had this assignment. When the police first informed my family about what had happened, they didn't have a lot of information. They did know, though, that whoever did it without any forced entry, which made them think that it was someone she knew.
We knew that she had a boyfriend and that there was some disharmony between the two of them.
The detectives interview Cheryl's boyfriend at length.
Both in terms of being in at another place at that time, and also his character, his nature, it just didn't make any sense to us.
This young man was very much traumatized about what had happened to his girlfriend.
We were absolutely convinced that he had nothing to do with it.
Detectives go back to the one concrete piece of evidence they have, the taped call to police reporting the crime. They suspect it's the voice of the killer.
The call was made by a person who was very matter-of-fact, unexcitable, monotone.
The exact words were, "Radio room, please.
I'm the superintendent at 33 Isabella Street. There's a dead body in apartment 1611.
I'm gonna hang up now. I'm gonna be sick." Because he said, "I'm gonna be sick," G-O-N-N-A. We didn't feel he was particularly well-educated.
36 hours into the investigation, Boothby and Oldham still have not slept.
Although you're very mentally and physically tired, you keep thinking, what are the next steps? Have we missed anything?
They return to Cheryl's apartment in search of new leads.
We took a moment just to stand at the scene and let it speak to us, because that's what scenes of crime do. They cry out to be interpreted. The Bell telephone jack had been removed from the wall, and the telephone had been disconnected from the jack.
We saw that in her journal, she had an entry in there, Bell Repair 611.
The detectives re-interview residents of the building.
We found that a person purporting to be a Bell telephone employee had been in the building and had made communications not only with Cheryl, but with another young woman. We contacted Bell Telephone and determined from then that they had made no such contact with anyone in the building and that they did not have a service person there.
Then it started to make some sense. Maybe somebody gained entry by posing as a telephone repairman.
After 72 hours, we had the voice of the killer. We had information about his character, his sinister behavior of taking on the identity of a Bell telephone repairman.
The detectives are getting a clearer picture of how the killer operates, but they have no idea who he is or what he plans to do next. Police believe someone posing as a telephone repairman brutally murdered model Cheryl Gardner.
We had to have a closed casket. And I still remember looking at the casket and thinking, this is all a mistake. There's no way she's in there. Please, somebody wake me out of this bad dream. We still didn't know what had happened. The police were working really hard.
The autopsy report comes in. There are no signs of sexual assault, but the murder weapon is identified.
The pathologist determined without doubt that the instrument was a hammer. The difficult features were the overkill. Why so much trauma? What type of person is this guy? Why did he commit defense the way he did?
The detectives speculate on one possible explanation.
We discussed this and thought that we were probably dealing with a psychopath.
If true, it would explain why the killer phoned in his own crime. Psychopaths crave attention. The detectives believe their man has probably been in trouble with police before.
Forensic psychologists tell us over and over again that criminals do not start out by killing. They start out by lying, cheating, stealing, breaking into houses, setting fires.
Police decide to play his call for every officer on the force.
We thought we'll play that over and over again on the radio system.
A fellow officer, Detective Boyd, tells Boothby he recognizes the voice on the tape. He just can't put a name to it. Oldham and Boothby try a new approach. They revisit Cheryl's apartment, this time with her best friend, Tanya.
The best thing to do, we found, was to bring someone to the scene, traumatic as it is to them emotionally, and tell us what has been changed.
Although the murder was horrific, the scene was relatively organized. Psychopaths often keep a scene quite organized. She walked around the room. All of a sudden, she said words to the effect that, oh my God, she says, the tape recorder is gone. The tape machine's gone.
Predators often take tokens, they take trophies, because they have very, very active fantasy lives. And the token and the trophy will let them relive the fantasy of the killing.
Police get another tip from a resident of Cheryl's building. He reports having seen a stranger wandering the halls delivering flyers just prior to the murder.
The witness related that he thought he had recognized him from the animal shelter.
At the shelter, a veterinarian tells police he recently fired a man who matches the description. His name is Ralph Power.
The animal shelter had contacted the police about Ralph Power's behavior when he worked there.
There was some suggestion that while he was there at the animal shelter that he had tortured cats.
But the veterinarian has no idea where Power is now. Police look up Ralph Power's record and learn he'd been jailed for attempted murder and was now on parole.
Power had just got out of jail for pouring gasoline into a mail chute of a woman's apartment and setting it on fire. She was seriously injured, burned badly. He got 10 years for that offense.
Quite often, psychopaths torture animals, set fires. These are some of the classic traits.
Detective Boyd, who had earlier recognized the voice on the tape, confirms that it belongs to Ralph Power.
He said, that voice, that is him.
The detective had spoken to Power following complaints from the animal shelter. Boothby and Oldham need to find Ralph Power. But before they can, they receive a call about an attack at 240 Wellesley Street, a few blocks from Cheryl Gardner's apartment. The victim is Jessie Boudreaux. She, too, is a model.
She had let the person into her apartment on the pretext that he was a Bell telephone repairman.
As soon as he entered the apartment, he went to where the phone service was and then suddenly attacked her with a hammer, and he was going to kill her. And she was able to get the hammer away from him and hit him with the hammer. The apartment door was open just a little bit. She lunged for the latch, opened the door, and escaped from him.
We took a photo lineup, 10 or 12 pictures. And I'll never forget her reaction. She just went hysterical and said, that's him, I'm positive, that's him.
We're dealing with a suspect that attacked two women within the period of a week. We still haven't arrested him. There's a perception that he will strike again. We got to get this guy quick, or the city's going to go into shutdown.
But where could he be? Police now know Cheryl Gardner's killer has attacked another woman. Their suspect is Ralph Power. He's out on parole, having served time for attempted murder. the detectives are shocked when they learn Ralph Powers' address.
We found out from records at the parole office that he was living at 240 Wellesley.
The same building where the second attack has just occurred.
When we went to arrest Ralph Power and execute the warrant to search, we couldn't get any reply at his apartment.
Both of us had worked in drug squads and found a much safer way to get into an apartment rather than kick a door in, just simply make a phone call and say, hey, the cops are coming, you better get out.
The ploy works.
Now, initially, he was extremely defiant. He was going to sue us. We had the wrong person. He objected to being arrested. But Cheryl Gardner's tape recorder was in his apartment, along with other paraphernalia that was very similar to the disguise he was using as the Bell Telephone repairman.
When I found out that he was arrested, there was a huge sense of relief, but there was also so many questions. Who is this person, and why did you do this to my sister?
He said to us, using his words, no bullshit, what do you guys got? We told him that he had been identified, that Cheryl's tape recorder was found in his apartment. He thought for a little while, and then he said, get me a coffee. I'll tell you all about it. This guy still wants to grandstand. He's still looking for gratification for what he's done. Let's put a tape recorder out and let him go. He's going to tell us quite a story. And he did.
And he gave a 45 minutes full confession in amazing detail, just amazing detail. He told us about spending literally hours and hours looking with his telescope and looking for what he called his potential candidates.
Power was looking for beautiful young women he wanted to sexually assault.
He was going to target what he said would be 10 women in downtown Toronto.
Once he had Cheryl in his sights, he found out as much about her as possible.
He was very clever at fooling people. He is not the type of person, if you met him on an elevator, that you would expect would be a killer.
He talks about two other men in there, and she sneezed quite loudly and said, I hope I'm not allergic to one of you. When she got off, Power said to one of the other guys, she can be allergic with me anytime.
He went to the floor above her apartment.
Power races to the staircase, then down to the floor below.
And he would put advertisement flyers in doors, so when he went to the floor to determine where his potential victim had gone, he could determine the one missing is in all probability where his intended victim was living. Look through the mail chute to determine whether or not it would be risky or not risky to attack her at that time.
He called Bell information, got Cheryl Gardner's name, her phone number, and that's when he called her and said it was Bell Repair.
Power booked an appointment to work on Cheryl's line. He made himself a fake ID badge. He printed up a fake work order and presented it to her when he arrived for his appointment.
And then his plan was to, as he said, not to kill anybody, but to stun them with his hammer, just sort of hit them on the head and stun them while he did his sexual thing.
But things didn't go as Power had planned. After striking Cheryl in the head, she began having a seizure.
He said to us, I didn't want to see her suffering like that. That wasn't fair. Then he added, she might recover and be able to recognize me. And so he said he then struck her again and made sure that she was dead.
Carr says he called police, posing as the building's superintendent.
I'm gonna hang up now. I'm gonna be sick.
Then waited to watch them arrive.
And he said in his confession, the chase was better than the kill. And I kind of got the feeling that this was part of the excitement of this rampage. When I looked into Ralph Power's eyes, I saw a person without conscience or empathy. His eyes, they just looked like two black holes.
In 1983, Ralph Power is sentenced to life with no chance of parole for 25 years. But it's not enough for Cheryl's sister, Carolyn.
You can't change what happened in the past, but you can definitely influence the future.
In 2006, Carolyn Gardner succeeds in pushing Parliament to pass a law requiring dangerous criminals like Carla Homolka and Ralph Power to have their DNA on file forever. Ralph Power's next parole hearing will be in July 2008.
My family and I will be there to make sure that Ralph Power stays behind bars for the rest of his life.
As long as I'm alive, if there's any way that I can prevent this animal from getting out, I'll do it.
The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case.